Hello, I'm your host, Carmen Bango, and this is The Pain Game, a podcast that examines the complexities of the human pain experience through conversation. On this episode, I sat down with biologist and neuroscientist Professor Matt Carter of Williams College to get into some pain science. Hello and welcome to the Pain Game. I'm your host, Carmen Bango, and today I'm here with Professor Matt Carter. Professor, how are you doing?
I'm great. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Matt Carter, and I teach in the biology department at Williams, and I'm part of the neuroscience program here. And I study the neural basis of hunger and sleep and behaviors that you don't have to teach an animal how to do. All mammals instinctually eat and sleep or drink water. And so those are behaviors that we routinely study. But I also teach classes in neuroscience. And one of the big topics in one of my classes, Neurosystems and Circuits, is pain and sensory stimuli. And it's a fun topic that I like learning about and reading about. Even though it's not the primary focus of my lab, but I like talking about it. It's a fascinating topic.
Great. So from that standpoint, could you give us a working definition of pain or something, somehow you would convey pain in your class?
Sure. So my definition of pain is that pain is an emotion, and it is often caused by a stimulus from like an external stimulus outside the body, or sometimes a stimulus inside the body, but it's more of an emotion than caused by an environmental event. It's often a response to environmental event, but there are some kinds of pain syndromes which are disorders of the neural system, in which case there's no stimulus, but it's always an internal representation of how the body is having you feel about a stimulus. And I think the key word is feel. It's a subjective experience. And as humans, we know what it feels like to be in pain. And we know, a variety of environmental stimuli that can cause different kinds of pain. But it's a really open question how animals would define pain. We know that things that we don't like, other animals don't like, but what they're experiencing is a big mystery to us. It's interesting. Pain is it's an internal representation of something that we're experiencing, but it's more of an emotion than anything else, as opposed to something caused by a physical stimulus. So, for example, touch. When something touches your body, you can claim that is a physical event, and we can precisely define the physical stimulus and that is caused by something that we can measure. Whereas pain is a reaction to something. It's really an emotion, and it's a phenomenon entirely generated by the brain.
Okay, so I'm just curious. So the way you teach about hunger, would you also say that that's a emotion or more of a physical response? Or?
Yeah, great question. I absolutely, yes. So it's interesting. When you think of emotions, you think of happy, sad, mm-hmm. scared. But so many more subjective experiences representations of how you're feeling are also emotions. I would absolutely say that hunger is an emotion. I would say that being full is an emotion. Being tired is an emotion. And we don't usually think of those as being emotions because they seem like they're correlated with our physiological state and what mm-hmm. we're doing. And they also seem like they just happen. It seems like obviously if you don't eat lunch and it's around dinner time and you haven't eaten dinner yet, our body is so good at generating this emotion, it seems like obviously we would feel hungry. But it's an emotion in this, again, I think the key word is feel. Like you feel hungry, you feel full, you feel tired. Feel is usually a word that is ascribed to an emotional state. And pain is exactly the same way. Pain is something that we have evolved to experience as an unpleasant situation to get us to fix something that could be wrong. just like hunger is an unpleasant state that motivates us to consume food, or being thirsty is an emotion that is an unpleasant state that drives us to go consume water. And so they're all separate emotions that we can distinguish. We're never confused as to whether we're hungry or thirsty. We can distinguish those emotions. And different states of pain are the same way. We can distinguish between whether we might have a minor cut on a hand or something, or on an arm, or if there's more serious damage, we can distinguish between hot pain or cold pain. There's different qualities to it, but it's all a motivational emotion designed to get us to do something, whether it's designed to get us to take care of an injury or designed to get us to stop behavior so we can rest and we can treat something. But I absolutely think that they're all emotions, which is an interesting point of view that most people don't consider.
Okay, so what about itchiness?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting with touch. When people think of sensations, we're taught in elementary school and grade school that we have five senses. So we're like sight, smell, hearing, taste, and touch. But when you think about touch can be unpacked into so many different senses. And I actually, the idea that we have five senses, I think is a huge myth in its own right. It's a huge simplification. I mean, people don't really, you have a vestibular sense, you have like all sorts of other senses that we don't talk about. Like you have a proprioception sense, is where your limbs are in space. We don't think of those as senses just because they're not usually on our conscious minds, but we have way more than five senses. But when it comes to touch, touch can be further dissected into more of a mechanical touch, like the physical presence that there's something on your skin, and even that can be dissected into different kinds of receptors in your skin that perceive stretch versus push or a pull versus stretch versus vibration. There's actually dedicated receptors in your skin that can tell if something's vibrating. So even mechanical touch can be differentiated. But then you have thermosensation. We have a range of temperatures we can discriminate. There's painful transduction. We actually call the transduction of pain nociception rather than pain reception. And we can talk about this, but we call it nociception because it's really noxious detection. You're detecting something noxious on your skin, and we interpret that as painful. But we call it nociception because we can more easily define the noxious stimulus than we can define whether it should be painful or not. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that. But itch is another fascinating thing you bring up. There are definitely specific stimuli which cause this itchy sensation, and you're exactly right. I would call itchiness an emotion. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think of being having an itch to scratch as an emotion, but it's a motivated state that you really want to try to get something off your skin, the kinds of environmental stimuli that would cause an itch are the kinds of things that you would want as an animal to try to just remove from your skin. You would want to just try to take it off. So this itchy sensation is basically a way of your body and your brain motivating you to scratch something and get something off of your skin. Sometimes it's a response to the immune response, to the inflammatory response. It's like if you cut yourself, or if you have a bruise, or there's certain plants that are very good at causing an inflammatory response, like poison ivy or something, that creates an itchy sensation as well. But the goal is to keep the skin clean, to get stuff not to touch the skin. And I maybe other people would disagree, but I absolutely would call itch an emotion in a way. Yeah. Because wow. You feel itchy,
and
right?
You have that motivated response.
That's
to
right.
Attend to it.
That's right. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I feel like we're presented with kind of a conflict here, because we're thinking of pain and hunger and itchiness maybe is emotions, and we can understand them on the human level, but what about studying these things in animals, and can we ever really study them in something that's not a human?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's also a huge challenge, because obviously if you want to study emotions, you can study them in humans easily in terms of you can ask a human subject what he or she is experiencing, and they can give you a very detailed report of what they're experiencing in language. But with a human, you can't inflict major pain. You could obviously never do experiments that would cause long-term damage, even short-term damage. You know, they're very highly regulated experiments, and the way people study pain in humans is really to inflict a very minor event, or to work with people who are experiencing pain because of some event, or, you know, as case studies, as patients who are navigating pain. But in a controlled environment, we can study pain in animals, but then the conflict is exactly the opposite as humans is. We also try to mitigate, long-term damage or pain in animals. But nobody wants an animal to suffer. But the hardest aspect is you can't ever know for sure what the animal is experiencing. The only thing we can know really is what they do behaviorally, so we can just watch them and see, you know, like, for example, with itch, you know, if we put on an itchy stimulus, we can see if they take their legs and start scratching themselves in the same way we would, so we would know a little bit more about that. And the other thing we can know is valence. We can know whether they tend to like it or not. And so there are some procedures that have been developed. For example, this is just one out of a few, but something called a condition place preference, where you put animals in, they have a choice between two rooms. And in one of the rooms, you give them some sort of stimulus, and in the other room, there's no stimulus. And then you ask them which room do they tend to want to spend their time on. And by the way, this works in humans as well. It's like, we're sort of unconscious to this, but it also works, you know. For example, if a student has a really difficult class that caused them a lot of anxiety in one classroom, and in another classroom they had a class that they really loved, it also kind of works naturally that if given a choice of the study spots, they will unconsciously choose the room that had less anxiety and less stress on their schedules. But it really works in animals a lot, and so we can measure, like, just ask the question, does what I'm doing to this animal, does the animal like it? And we can tell that for the things that cause humans pain, especially in rodents and other mammals, they don't like it. They do the same kinds of things we would if we were in pain. They if we get a cut, we tend to want to hold the cut and put it under cold water. They tend to do the same thing. They tend to lick it. They'll withdraw their paw. They won't use it. And so we can tell that for sure they're experiencing some subjective measure of pain, but you just never really know. And it's fascinating, actually, when you look at the entire animal kingdom. You can take a C. elegans worm, which is this microscopic worm, you can't even see it unless you have a microscope, and you can have a really fine-tipped little poker, microscopic poker, and you can poke the worm, and the worm moves away, and it looks like the worm doesn't like it. But I don't think anyone would claim that the worm is experiencing anything like the emotion of pain. I mean, this is a little worm. It's like, I don't know if it experiences emotion whatsoever. I don't think it's got the neural capability of these emotional systems. And if it seems like I don't know what I'm talking about, nobody knows what they're when we talk about, like, why do you even feel an emotion, or how can you feel a quality or a valence in the first place? Nobody really knows the answer to that question. But it's obvious the worm doesn't like it. And I think one of these big debates that comes up is, like cooking a lobster, for example. It's like people take lobster and they boil the lobster. And I think for decades, the excuse has been, well, the lobster doesn't feel pain. My opinion is nobody has any idea. If you chase a lobster, if you put a hot stimulus on a lobster, the lobster will run away. So it's obvious that the lobster has an evolutionary circuit or reflex to avoid hot temperatures or painful temperatures. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's feeling it. You know, that just means it could be a reflex. It could be, you can program a robot to avoid hot temperatures. We could make a little robot that's capable with wheels and stuff, and you could, have temperature detectors so that the robot feels the hot temperature and then will move away from it in a survival strategy. But that doesn't mean that the robot is feeling anything. It's just a computational reflex. So this is where it just gets fascinating, is that the closer evolutionary we tend to see other animals, like rodents, for example, mice or mammals. They're very, you know, they're much closer to us evolutionarily than a lobster is. We tend to see the mouse and think it's experiencing the same thing that we're experiencing subjectively, but nobody knows. It's just one of these. I mean, if you want to just take this all the way it can possibly go, who's to say that what you experience when you feel mm-hmm. pain is the same as what I experience? You know, humans could have very different experiences, but at the end of the day, I don't think it's as loose as that. I think, you know, we all have thresholds that are relatively similar. You know, it's you know, you asked me to submerge my arm in ice water, I would want to take it out within a few seconds, and so would you. We're probably likely experiencing a very similar phenomenon. And, you know, if you put a mouse in ice water, it wants to get out right away. I'm assuming that we're across the kingdom, we're experiencing these same things. But it's a great question. So we study it the best we can, yeah. But we can never entirely be sure.
Yeah, definitely. So to add on to that, I heard about the study where humans were put in a closed room with a shocker, like mm-hmm. a little thing that if they went up to it would shock them.
Right.
And in this case, I think like more people in the room did end up shocking themselves, like even repeatedly. Hmm. And so if we're studying something like pain aversive behavior in rats and right. with shocks,
right.
Is that really even comparable to the human mind and like
right,
the
right.
other motivators for behavior.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, and this is another difference between humans and a lot of animals, is that when we know that there's no danger, we like to experience things that just sort of put us on the edge, just for sort of the thrill of it, you know. And so, like, I don't know, one example might be spicy foods, for example. You know, it's just like, I think if an animal were to eat something spicy, they tend to avoid it. So why is it that we like to put spicy sauces on our foods or something? It's because we know what it is, and we know that there's no damage, and we like spice up to a certain threshold. And some people like spicy things more than others, but everybody develops that threshold for themselves. And you know, we like things like roller coasters. We like, you know, like obviously these are controlled things. And so I'm wondering from that experiment, I haven't seen that study, but I wonder if, you know, sometimes there's, you know, conditions in which it's actually kind of fun to just experience something that you know is not going to cause, you know what I mean? It's yeah. just like you like for a thrill of it. But yeah, animals, it's interesting. It's, you know, something we talk about when we study animals is actually this word called validity. And validity is basically a question about how good is this animal model at mm-hmm. representing the human condition. And the three forms of validity is really, I guess, number one, does the animal look like it's experiencing the same thing that the human is? So, you know, if you put a mouse in a slightly, I don't know, give it a little slightly painful condition, does it respond in the same way that a human would? Like, does it lick its paw? Does it, you know, does it look behaviorally like what it's doing? The second form of validity is if there's some biological cause of a painful condition in a human, is the same exact cause manifest in that animal? So, for example, if there's an inflammatory response in a human, is the animal also experiencing an inflammatory response? Like, does the biological condition look the same? And the third is kind of a treatment form of validity, where you know, humans, we've developed all these analgesics and ways of controlling pain. So the question is, like, does the analgesic for a human also relieve behavioral signs of pain in a rodent? And a lot of ways people study pain is to look at all three of those things and to say, like, not only does the animal look like it's in pain, but the cause is very similar to what's causing a painful condition in a human. And if we put on analgesics or we give it something, you know, like a very similar to an over-the-counter medication, you know, like maybe ibuprofen or Tylenol or a cream or, you know, whatever, does the animal experience less symptoms of pain? And often they do. And so that gives pain researchers a very, you know, it's called validity because that makes them feel like the model is valid. Mm-hmm. And it makes it feel like it's a good way of studying what we're studying. Yeah.
So just trying to check as many boxes kind of to get the experiences comparable.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's not limited to pain, by the way. It's, you know, we scientists use validity to study human diseases. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like if you have a mouse model of Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease, you could use those three forms of validity to say, you know, yes, I think when I'm studying this mouse model of Parkinson's, the biological cause is the same, the symptoms are the same in the mouse as it is in the human disease, and the available treatments we have for Parkinson's disease in humans also seem to work in the animals, and so that gives people who study Parkinson's in mice a much more valid rationale for why those mice are a good way of studying Parkinson's in humans. But it definitely applies to pain research and itch research and everything we're talking about.
Great.
Yeah.
So you mentioned nociception.
Right.
Do you want to get into that a little?
Sure. Yeah. No, actually, well, it's a really fun topic. When I teach the neuroscience classes that we do, one of the ways I like to start out is by asking people what their definition of a painful stimulus is. And it's a really interesting question because I think, you know, people tend to think of awful things right away, you know, like fire or, you know, something sharp or some hot temperature or something like that. But when you think about it, compared to other senses, you can precisely define what the stimulus is when you're talking about the visual system, for example, like we're talking about photons of light or we're talking about specific wavelengths of light hitting the retina. We can measure that and we can precisely define what a visual stimulus is. Or an auditory stimulus, we can precisely define in terms of the pitch of sound, the amplitude of sound, and even for touch, we can define, you know, what is the object, what is the object vibrating, is the object stretching the skin. There are ways of quantifying that. But if you ask, what is a painful stimulus? There, you realize really quickly there's no way to define it. So for example, is a grain of sand a painful stimulus? You know, like is sand a painful stimulus? And so if you think about walking on the beach, no, it's not a painful stimulus. If you think, okay, if I have a grain of sand on my arm, is that going to cause me pain? No. But what if you have a grain of sand that gets in your eye? Then it could be a very painful stimulus, especially if it gets in between the eye and a contact lens or something like that. You know, and then, you know, when I bring this up in classes, people start to squirm because they instantly realize how in that situation it would be painful. And so there are some stimuli, you know, like fire, for example. Fire causes, you know, sort of an instantaneous, it's way too hot, it causes tissue damage, and I can't think of a time in which the skin could come in contact with fire in which it wouldn't be painful. But there are a lot of stimuli that are much more variable than that and could cause pain. You know, even, I mean, I don't want to, it's funny talking about pain, it starts to get graphic very quickly, but like, is a spoon a painful stimulus? A knife could be, you know, like it's easy to think of a knife as being able to cause pain. Could a spoon cause pain? Usually not, but like in the right condition, if you happen to step on a spoon, if you were barefoot in the middle of the night, it could hurt your foot. You know, if somehow a spoon was pressed into your skin too much, it would start to cause pain. So there's no such thing as a painful stimulus, which is why we don't call it pain detection. We call it nociception. And we call it nociception because really the body is not trying to detect pain, because pain is more of the emotional response. It's trying to detect something that could cause tissue injury or cause bodily damage. And so it's noxious detection, or we just call it nociception. And over the, you know, thousands, millions of years of evolution, the nervous system has evolved to be able to detect things likely to cause tissue damage. And because that is not beneficial for the organism, we interpret that in a negative valence, and we call it pain. And so when we talk about nociception, really what we're talking about is what is likely to be present when there's tissue damage, and how are the cells of the nervous system configured to be able to detect those things. And so nociception, there's lots of different neurons in the periphery that, you know, they have neural axonal processes that go out to the skin, and they are all really uniquely wired to detect different kinds of things that are likely to be present if there's a noxious stimulus. So, for example, there are some cells that are hardwired to detect noxious high temperatures. And there are some cells that are hardwired to detect noxious cold temperatures. And, you know, if your, you know, your arm happens to be next to something extremely hot or extremely cold, those neurons start to fire. And then, it, you know, they inform the brain that it's, you know, you should move your arm or whatever it be as soon as possible to avoid the damage. Then there are completely other groups of neurons that are designed to recognize breakage in the skin when there's tissue damage. If you cut yourself with a knife or something, the cells are damaged, and when the cells release some of their contents, some of those contents are able to cause the activation of specific receptors on neurons, and then those neurons are able to basically detect that a cell has been ruptured in a non-controlled way, and so it signals to the brain that something has happened at the skin. And again, we interpret that aversively, like we don't like that sensation. And so there's all sorts of neurons that are just basically hardwired to be nociceptors. They're basically hardwired not to detect, you know, what we think of as our painful stimuli, but things that could cause bodily harm. And that's why I think of as pain as an emotion. Pain is the response to those things. Pain is not, there's nothing in the outside world that you could just call a painful stimulus on its own. It's like that's our reaction to the painful stimulus.
Great.
Yeah.
So we have these specialized cells.
Right.
But we also have our past experiences with pain. And also probably our prediction mechanisms to predict when something is going to be painful. So what are some of the other things that go into influencing a pain experience, and how do they work with the nociceptors, and maybe are also separate from nociception?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think of pain, nociception, I think of nociception as being a very specific event that happens somewhere in the body that doesn't tend to change with prior experience. So, you know, so if you get a paper cut one day and you remember what it was like to get the paper cut, it's not going to change what the neurons do the next time you get a paper cut or somewhere else in the body. The neurons will fire the same way. But how you deal with it in terms of your own subjective experience can definitely change based on prior experience and also ways of dealing with pain. I mean, I think another fascinating aspect of pain is pain management and setting your expectations for what a painful stimulus is or how to treat it. And so I think young kids, obviously, you know, I have young kids now. I have a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old, and when they encounter a nociceptive event, I'll call it that, you know, they cry and they have a hard time dealing with it. Whereas if I myself have the same stimulus happen to me, it still causes me pain. It's not because I'm used to it that it doesn't cause pain, but as we grow up, we find all these ways of dealing with it to basically self-soothe ourselves either through physical mechanisms. So like, for example, when you get a cut on your finger or something, you rub it. You put it under cold water and you rub it. But even if you don't have an opportunity to put it under cold water, rubbing it actually, there's a neural circuit in which the touch surrounding a painful stimulus actually inhibits the painful stimulus. And so the signaling from the nociceptors is reduced when you rub something. And so you can self-soothe that way. But you can also tell yourself and coach yourself about what's going to happen. So, you know, if you step on a Lego in the middle of the night or you stub your toe, I mean, actually it's interesting when somebody stubs their toe. They, you know, usually you know you stubbed your toe before the pain hits you. You know, you have about a second before you
have that experience.
Yeah, right? Yeah. The reason for that, by the way, is that the touch neurons fire faster than the pain neurons. So you have from the distance from your toe to your brain, you really do have a second or two because the pain information hasn't arrived at your brain yet. So you're conscious that you stubbed your toe, but then you know you have about a second or two. But that's great, and I think that the body definitely evolved that way so that you have a second or two to respond and to prepare yourself for what's about to happen. And it probably evolved that way just so that you wouldn't cause yourself further likelihood of further damage, or if you're carrying something. I mean, imagine you're carrying a baby and then you stub your toe, it's nice to be able to prepare yourself for the pain so you don't react and potentially cause damage to your... Right, exactly, right. But when you know you stub your toe and you know that the pain's about to arrive, you know, like as you grow from a young kid, you develop strategies, mental strategies of telling yourself. And you also know what it's like. So you know that when you stub your toe, you're not going to feel that pain for days. You can just be like, okay, this is going to suck for 5 minutes. This is going to be a bad experience, but you can rub it. You can distract yourself. Actually, you know, it is really, distraction is a very powerful technique, and it's a valid technique. You actually do feel less subjective measures of pain if you're able to distract yourself by doing something else. And so, all of those things, like prior experience and just telling yourself how long should this last? How well did past methods of analgesia or soothing work? And even be able to predict pain. You know, it's like when you get a shot at the doctor's office, for example. It's like, I mean, when you're a kid, that's one of the worst things ever. And it's still not any pleasant when you're an adult. But at least you can prepare yourself for it, and you know that it's not likely to be. You know, you can reduce the fear in your own mind. You learn strategies of making it less painful. You know, and so. But yeah, the subjective experience of pain is also fascinating. I mean, there really are valid psychological ways of reducing pain that people don't really fully understand how that works, but it's real for sure.
So could you explain some of the pathways and regions in the brain that are responsible for more of the modulation of pain?
Yeah, for sure. It's so fascinating. I know this is my field, so I'm supposed to be fascinated by it, and I'm biased, but I think it's really fascinating. First of all, I think it's fascinating that pain and touch circuits are completely segregated, so that you know, when you stub your toe, the neurons that are sensing the mechanical sensation of stubbing your toe are completely different than the neurons that are going to interpret that as a noxious event. And they travel up the spinal cord together, they go to the brain together. As I said before, the touch goes at a slightly faster speed, so you get that information first. But they both go up together. But what's really interesting is that you can segregate different aspects of what you experience at the level of your skin. And pain actually separates when it gets to the brain as well. So if you're, I don't know, if you're talking about your leg or your arm or some part of your body, what's actually interesting, the neurons that are transducing those events actually live just outside your spinal cord. So they're actually kind of in your back, and they send these long axonal processes out to the skin. The skin is where the event takes place, and that information goes to those neurons, and those neurons then have this neural circuit pathway that goes up the spinal cord to the brain. But then the noxious detectors, from what we know about pain, they seem to go to different places in the brain. So they bifurcate, and some of them go to a part of your brain called somatosensory cortex, and the somatosensory cortex is where you seem to have a sort of a map of your body, and you're able to detect things on your body. So that's where you detect whether this was your toe or your elbow or your fingers. And what's fascinating is that the rare times there have been open brain surgery in humans, this is usually in response to some sort of neurological damage, and physicians have to go in and perform a brain surgery. But if a physician was to go find somatosensory cortex and apply just a little bit of stimulation to somatosensory cortex, then people feel like there's an event going on in their elbow or their toe or their wherever it happens to be in somatosensory cortex. So it really seems to be a representation of the body. But then this is where I think it's fascinating, is some of that pain information goes to somatosensory cortex, and then some of it goes to other places that we call the limbic system. And the limbic system of the brain is what we think of as where emotions are generated. And so it seems the location of the body and the detection that something has happened is different than the subjective experience of how we're going to feel about what happened. And it's fascinating because it just basically means that we interpret pain as a singular event. You know, if you put a candle right under the palm of your hand, that'll feel painful and too hot. But the brain is probably generating that subjective experience in different locations. And the heat, the negative valence of that, the fact that it feels very uncomfortable, the fact that you know it happened on your palm, they're actually happening in different spots of the brain. And it's completely unknown how the brain then combines these things into one solid experience, mm-hmm. so that you know what it is. And it's even more fascinating when you throw touch into the mix too. It's like if I handed you an ice cube and I said, squeeze this ice cube, you would not only feel the pain of grabbing the cold ice cube, but the brain would probably represent that in different areas. So you would feel the subjective aspects of it being cold and being painful in your limbic system. You would know it was in the palm of your hand in your somatosensory cortex. But then in a different spot in your somatosensory cortex, you'd also just feel the fact you have an object in your hand. Like that's even represented somewhere else. And so it's interesting that all of these little stimuli are represented in different places. But really, when we think of pain, it's the I think it's the emotional aspect of this that, and there are case studies of actually of people who have evolved not to be able to experience pain, and it's a terrible condition. It sounds like that would be great, but it actually turns out that these people suffer all sorts of injuries because they don't detect it. But they can often feel that something is happening. Sometimes they can, you know, if there's case studies where somebody will, you know, grab an ice cube, they can feel the ice cube. They just don't feel the pain of the ice cube. And so you can actually separate the mechanical aspects of it from the emotional aspects of it, which is, again, why I would think of as pain as more of an emotion than anything else.
Wow.
Yeah.
Super
interesting. Super cool. Yeah.
So I have a friend who recently scratched his cornea. Ooh, actually.
Yeah.
And apparently the pain was comparable to childbirth, which I don't even know how you compare those things.
Right.
He also experienced really bad pain in his other eye. I think he scratched his left eye.
Oh, interesting.
And he had pain in his right eye. And right. So the doctor described this as a phantom pain, even though,
yeah.
I don't know if I even like that phrase, phantom pain, because right. It was a real experience.
Right,
but
right.
It just wasn't where the injury was located.
Right. So this brings up, it's a really interesting thing. So I often, and everybody usually thinks of pain as being caused by some sort of a tissue damage or some sort of noxious event, but it's really unfortunate because pain is an emotion, the nervous system and disorders of the nervous system can sometimes cause these illusions where a person thinks they're in pain. And they it's not just that they think they're in pain. If they feel like they're in pain, they are. But there's no physical stimulus to actually cause it. And phantom pain is a really interesting thing. I usually hear the term phantom pain described in the case where somebody loses a limb. An arm has to be amputated or a leg is amputated. And often the result of that is that sometimes it doesn't happen right away, but eventually sometimes the person can feel like not only is their arm still there or their leg still there, but it hurts. And they actually feel very specific spots as if, almost as if they'd not only not lost their limb, but they could tell you specifically where on the limb they were feeling this phantom pain. And a lot of times what's happening is the neurons that used to regulate that limb, the limb is not there, but in the somatosensory cortex, those neurons are still there and they're still able to fire. And so sometimes the loss of a signal coming from the periphery, from the body, those neurons in the brain sometimes just don't know what to do. And they sort of reassign themselves. And there's a plasticity process that happens where those cells can sometimes fire abnormally caused by other events. And sometimes when I've heard of a lot of phantom limb cases, sometimes they get reassigned to basically process pain and touch to a neighboring part of the body. So if a part of the shoulder is touched in somebody who loses their arm, then that can cause the sensation that their arm is being touched, simply because those cells that used to regulate touch or pain in the arm have now been in a way reassigned to detect things from the nearby part of somatosensory cortex, in this case, the shoulder. But I've also heard of cases where it's not an amputated thing. So like your friend, there's definitely a possibility that perhaps the damage to the cornea could potentially cause pain in the other side, and there's no, like you say, there's no actual damage in the other side, but it's something that that person is experiencing, and it's a awful phenomenon that could happen. There's also disorders which I think are I mean it just sounds like a nightmare, where there's no trauma whatsoever. There's no nociceptive event. There's no limb amputated. There was never any damage to the skin, and people just develop this deep pain. There's something called thalamic pain syndrome, where and it's named because it's usually a disorder of the thalamus, which is this part of the brain where a lot of painful signals will travel through before they get to the cortex. And if there's dysregulation of this of the thalamus, they might feel intense pain for no reason. And this is horrific, because not only are they experiencing pain for no reason, but it's difficult to treat. You know, it's not like there's something on your body that you can just rub to take care of it. Right, disorders where this happens is a really unfortunate thing. And this is where more psychological treatments and you know, tricks where you can distract yourself. There's actually this famous example of pain treatment called real-time fMRI. So MRI is a technique where a physician can take an image of the brain, and fMRI, the F stands for functional, where you can actually measure neural activity in the brain. And this is not an invasive procedure. A lot of people have MRIs done. You just lie in this little metal tube, and it uses magnets basically to form these images of the brain. But there's this famous experiment that was done called real-time fMRI, where humans were put in an fMRI chamber, and they were allowed to see real-time feedback of what their brain was doing. So they could actually see the neural activity in certain parts of their brain live, which is kind of a weird thing to think about. You never really know what your brain is doing, you know, in real time. But what they did, these experimenters, was they put people who were experiencing pain that was a neurological disorder, it wasn't caused by a real stimulus, into these scanners, and they showed them the activity of parts of their brain that generated pain, and they were told to just do whatever it took to reduce the activity. And what they were able to do is, because they were able to see the real-time activity of their brain, they were actually able to figure out strategies to reduce the neural activity in their brain through meditation or through distraction or through other things. And it was a real thing. They not only did you see that the neural activity was decreasing, but they reported that they were experiencing a lot less pain than they did before. And so for people who are suffering from, you know, either phantom pain or thalamic pain syndrome, or something where there's a painful subjective experience in the absence of a physical cause, there are psychological treatments that are cause people to alleviate it to some degree. It works better in some people than others, but
wow, yeah. That's
fascinating.
So cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah. I love how they can see the measure of something, and that's measurable. And
yeah. In one case, they actually made the measure look like a hot poker. So they didn't show them, you know, a picture of their brain. They showed them a hot poker, and when the cells were active, the hot poker just was, you know, gleaming red. And then when the activity was down, it just became a sort of a duller gray color. And so it really correlated with the subjective, you know, experience of pain being like a really hot, painful, kind of like a hot poker kind of a thing. I thought that was an interesting thing to subjectively do that. And then they were just told, make the hot poker go down in terms of its stinginess or whatever. And yeah, it's fascinating.
So did this type of therapy work for just people with a localized region of pain? Or I know that some other forms of chronic pain, such as fibromyalgia,
right,
or chronic migraine, the pain isn't always so easily localized, or just can be in all parts of their body. And
It depends, I think, on what the underlying cause is. I've heard of this technique and psychological techniques being used for fibromyalgia. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's is a very debilitating form of pain. I mean, it's very painful. There's an absence of, a stimulus that's causing it. But people feel like they're just being constantly jabbed with pokers or something all over their body. And it sounds really awful. And I've heard of this technique being used for that. I've heard of psychological techniques. There's, in the popular media, like magazines and newspapers, I often meaning once every couple months, see a case study of somebody who's been suffering from something like fibromyalgia, and then they go to a treatment center, and they, over the course of weeks, they learn therapies, psychological meditation therapies that relieve their pain. And some of them report that the pain just completely goes away. Other people, it doesn't work in them as well as it works in somebody else. But it's fascinating. In the common press, people could probably Google stories, about treatments for this, where there's case studies where people can get back to work and they can function as normal because they've spent a week or two or longer, sometimes months, learning cognitive therapies for treatment of their disorders. But I think different causes of these syndromes are likely to produce different treatments. Like migraines, for example, migraines are still a big mystery in terms of headaches in general. Headaches can be caused by so many different things. Like a headache is actually a great question of what causes the typical headache. It's just there's so many different factors that cause headaches in different kinds of people, and migraines are somewhat of a mystery. What are the symptoms that cause a migraine? What triggers the onset of a headache in some people, and what causes migraines? Even in the same person, sometimes there's different events that cause a migraine, and so it's really hard to treat things where you don't really know the underlying cause. And it's much easier if it's cut on a finger or something like that, then exactly what it is. But there are lots of forms of pain that are it really is caused by something, but people don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah, I think what's fascinating about fibromyalgia is that it's way more common in females, I believe, and also there's sometimes a link between psychological trauma or events of stress and past abuse, even with cases of fibromyalgia. So definitely going into more of the therapeutic treatments for fibromyalgia, I think that can make a lot of sense. And unpacking all the different things that are going into that pain experience.
Right. Yeah, no, it's it's something interesting to bring up too, is that I really appreciate that people study this from all sorts of different points of view. And so there's sort of the hardcore biologists who are really interested in mechanism, and they're interested in the cells and the molecules that are involved with this and how they can be treated. And then there are the hardcore psychologists who come at this from a mind point of view, and the person and what their mind is going through. And I think there's a hope that, everybody attacking this from all sorts of different angles will somehow meet in the middle, and we'll figure out not only the best ways to treat something like pain psychologically through meditation or cognitive therapy, but we'll actually be able to figure out why that's working at a molecular or cellular level, and it'll unite everything. But I think right now everyone is just chipping away the edges of the mountain, hoping that we meet somewhere in the middle. And that's why it's such a fascinating thing to talk about, is I think it will really require all sorts of different fields, and also basic science and clinical science kind of coming at this together. Basic scientists just interested in understanding pain as a biological, psychological phenomenon, and then clinical scientists who actually see patients who, are on the forefront of actually seeing, these different diseases themselves. And I think there's a big hope that at some point everybody will meet in the middle, and we'll have a much fuller understanding of what causes all this.
Yeah, and that's why I love thinking about pain as an output and a subjective experience instead of just a sensory input, which I think is still kind of, I don't know, that idea does get miscommunicated a lot. And
it does.
There's so many experts that can have a say.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, just like many other mental disorders too, it's like, I think in our society, I think over the past few decades, people have gotten much better about mental disorders in terms of realizing their significance along with physical disorders. It's if somebody breaks their leg or, you know, there's an obvious injury somewhere, it's much easier to see that in a person compared to depression or anxiety and, you know, other mental health conditions. But I think, you know, colleges and schools and the rest of society are doing much better at understanding mental disorders, but it still applies to pain in that way too. It's like, this is, again, like coming back to the general theme that pain is a mental condition. It's a subjective experience, is that the pain management aspect of all of this is, sometimes there's tissue injury to go along with it and sometimes there isn't. And so the treatment of pain is really, in some ways, a mental condition. Obviously, if there's an immediate physical stimulus to go along with that, that needs to be treated also. but the treatment of a lot of these long-term pain disorders is one of these mental health conditions that sometimes people don't recognize.
Great. Cool. So I think we're almost wrapping up, but is there anything else that you'd like to tell the listeners about pain, or from any insights from your personal life or research? Or
sure. Yeah, no, I just, it's fascinating. I guess like one kind of grand mystery to end on is just how does the brain make this aversive to begin with? You know, I think that the nervous system has been, there have been huge advances in even just the past 10 years. You know, for example, 10, 15 years ago, nobody had really any idea how taste worked. We were able to know that certain neurons on the tongue fired in response to certain things being put on the tongue, but nobody really knew how different tastes were transduced on the tongue into a neural signal and where that neural signal went in the brain. And now, 10 or 15 years later, we know so much more about where taste comes from and what the nervous system is doing during taste, but we still don't have any idea why sweet things taste good or why bitter things don't taste good, and we tend to avoid them. We know the stimuli and we know where they go in the brain, and we know, you know, different aspects of it, but we don't know how something, you know, the brain composed of just cells is able to make us feel good or feel bad. And so it's interesting from a taste point of view, or even a, you know, olfactory point of view, we can identify things that we like and things that we don't like, and we know the different neurons that are involved, but we don't have any idea where the subjective experience of pleasure or sadness or pain comes from. And so pain is particularly hard because it is purely a subjective experience. You know, it's like we know the tissue damage, and so we can map out the tissue damage, but I think right now the taste neuroscientists are this is my own opinion, it's hard right now because now we've made so much progress. We can map taste from the tongue to the gustatory cortex, and we've made so much progress, but then there's the question still, how could a bunch of neurons make you like something that's sweet or not like something that's very bitter? Like, how in the world does that subjective experience, like, you, again, you could make a robot able to detect something that's sweet or detect something that's bitter and avoid the bitter things and pursue the sweet things, but the robot's probably not actually experiencing the pleasure of tasting something sweet. And so now the taste neuroscientists are having sort of a hard time because now this is the next big frontier. And for pain, that's been the frontier sort of all along. Like, we know now, you know, actually we've known for years what causes the painful stimulus in terms of tissue damage, and we know where it goes in the brain. But the big frontier is, how could these cells in the limbic system make you feel terrible and make you feel in so much discomfort? And that, I think, is going to require a breakthrough on the level of Darwin or Einstein. Some genius or a group of people are going to have to come up with a theory as to how do cells that are talking to each other result in something pleasant or unpleasant. And I don't think anyone has even any idea how to start cracking that. And so with pain, it's a particularly fascinating thing to study right now because it's just so hard, just for that reason, to generate how could this be, which is why it's great that people are coming at it from all sorts of different angles, because eventually we'll get there. And with people studying the treatment of pain and the alleviation of pain, or different cognitive therapies, and other people understanding the biological events that cause it in the first place, there's a hope that maybe there'll be some insight into why is this aversive in the first place. It's fascinating.
Great. Well, that's a lot of great questions to end on. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.